Last week, we introduced you to the case of Jacob Wideman, a man who in 1986, when he was 16, murdered his summer camp roommate. A new podcast from WBUR and the Marshall Project, called Violation, is taking a closer look at America's inconsistent and mysterious parole system through Jacob's story. This week, reporter Beth Schwartzipfel picks up the story a week after the brutal murder.
In late August 1986, no one knew where Jake was. A week prior, 16-year-old Eric Kane had been discovered stabbed to death in an Arizona motel room. No one had heard from Jake Wideman, the boy he'd been rooming with, since the murder. The Oldsmobile they'd been driving with a group from their summer camp was also missing. With Eric dead and not a word from Jake, the minds of Jake's parents, John and Judy, were spinning into every imaginable nightmare scenario.
I remember a few days after hearing you were missing and a boy found dead in the room the two of you had been sharing. I remember walking down towards the lake to be alone because I felt myself coming apart. The mask I'd been wearing as much for myself as for the benefit of other people was beginning to splinter. I could hear ice cracking.
John Wideman had already won acclaim with more than half a dozen books that grappled with racism, violence, and the criminal justice system. All of those issues had hit close to home for him already, but never quite this close. This passage is from an essay he wrote years later, reflecting on that terrible week.
I was afraid you were dying or already dead or suffering unspeakable tortures at the hands of a demon kidnapper.
A few days after Eric was murdered, the blue Oldsmobile was found abandoned near the bus station in Phoenix, about 2 hours south of Flagstaff. The camper's belongings were untouched in the trunk, clothing, cameras, Walkman. But $70 in cash and some $3,000 worth of traveler's checks that the counselor, Bill Hammond, had stashed under the driver's seat were missing.
Well, the kid was on the lam.
This is Ted Bartimus, the Arizona Daily Sun reporter.
They didn't know where he was at.
The missing traveler's checks began turning up cashed at Greyhound bus terminals, motels, and airports in Los Angeles, Denver, Minneapolis, and New York. Flagstaff police spoke to the clerk at one hotel on Long Island, and she described the person who checked in as Mr. Hammond as being in his early 20s, about 6 feet tall, and maybe Puerto Rican, judging from his complexion. He seemed to be suspicious and, quote, up to something, she said. For 7 days, Jake wandered aimlessly on buses and planes.
And it took the bus to L.A., and then I may have spent the night in L.A. It's foggy.
He met a girl on a Greyhound who told him to come visit her outside Duluth. But when he arrived, he discovered she lived in a group home for troubled teens, and he was not allowed in.
My parents have said, my dad in particular, that as that week went on, it became more and more clear to them that it probably wasn't the case that I had been kidnapped. And then they didn't want to draw, of course, the logical conclusion.
Over the course of that week, the reality of what he had done began to sink in, Jake said. And by the time he found himself stranded in Minnesota with very little money and nowhere left to go, he realized it was time to call his family.
I think that both ends of the conversation, we were just kind of in a fugue state, I guess is the best way to explain it. Nobody really knew what to say other than to just figure out what I should do. I know they told me that they loved me and they were with me no matter what.
7 days after Eric Kane was found murdered in Flagstaff, Jake arrived in Arizona and met his attorneys for the first time. His parents had frantically arranged to hire lawyers in Phoenix, knowing Jake would need them. Jake and his family stayed together in a hotel. They probably talked. They must have eaten. His brother Daniel said they may or may not have played a pickup game of basketball. But no one remembers any details about that night. It was all a blur. On August 21st, 1986, Jake Wideman arrived at the Flagstaff Police Department with his parents and his attorneys and surrendered. He was wearing a Princeton Day School jacket, a pair of Converse high tops, and a blue cap. Flagstaff Police Detective Frank Manson notes that he asked one of Jake's attorneys if there was some simple or logical explanation for Jacob's disappearance, which might show his innocence and eliminate the defendant as a suspect so that the investigation might continue in other areas. Jake's attorney told Detective Manson that no explanation would be offered.
We had lots of theories about what had happened in his brain at that time and what caused it. And the doctors who evaluated him had various theories. We had some really great...
This is another one of his attorneys from that time, Patty Guerin.
But because Jake just wasn't able to talk about anything, I mean, he was a 16-year-old. He just wasn't able to talk with any insight about what his life had been like as a child and growing up, because everybody thought he had a very normal life. And in many respects, he had a very normal, wonderful life.
The day after Jake surrendered, a judge said there wasn't enough evidence to keep him in jail, for now. There was little more than circumstantial proof that Jake had killed Eric. It seemed completely out of character. There was no obvious motive, and Jake wasn't talking. So the judge released Jake to the custody of his parents. In the midst of all of this, the family was in the process of moving from Laramie, Wyoming, to Amherst, Massachusetts, where John had landed a new teaching job. In Massachusetts, they had Jake admitted to a psychiatric hospital, which, according to Jake and his attorneys, was wary of having a kid charged with murder at their facility. This was more than 30 years ago, and juvenile records are sealed, so I'm relying on the memories of Jake and his attorney, as well as court transcripts and documents that describe the events. But according to them, Jake and a bunch of kids at the hospital were roughhousing one day. He tackled or wrestled with another kid while playing ball, and the staff, already on high alert, called the police.
And so I first met Jake in the juvenile holding dock cell in the Boston Juvenile Court to get arraigned on an assault and battery charge.
Patty Guerin again.
And I went into his cell, and he was curled up in a ball on the floor, hugging his knees, crying. And that's how we met.
For decades, Eric Kane's family and friends have insisted this incident at the psych hospital was attempted murder, that Jake was trying to strangle this kid. But both Jake and Patty, and the police officer who investigated the incident, say that's just not what happened.
A very nice Boston police officer came and testified that he didn't think anything happened other than the hospital didn't want him there and the judge dismissed the charges.
It's important to remember that when Jake first turned himself in to the police, he didn't confess to the murder. He didn't plead guilty. It was just the beginning of a long legal fight. This happens all the time. But after Jake had been admitted to the psychiatric hospital in Boston, he did something that shocked his family and his legal team, something that changed the trajectory of his case and his life. Ted Bartimus recalls how one day in September, not even a month after the crime, Flagstaff Police Detective Mike Ciccinelli got a call.
Basically, the kid spilled his guts to Detective Ciccinelli, I believe his name was. And so I'd hate to have been Jacob's lawyer.
Jake, who had not yet turned 17, told Ciccinelli to turn on a tape recorder. He wanted to make a statement. "I murdered Eric Kane," Jake said. It was the first time he had said this out loud to anyone except his lawyers. "I deeply, deeply regret what happened," Jake said, according to the transcript. "I want you to understand that, and I want everybody to understand that." Jake's family and his lawyers had no idea he was going to confess to the police. And when Jake made that phone call, he made his lawyers' jobs a lot harder. The judge ordered Jake held in a juvenile detention facility in Arizona. Patty Guerin says the legal team's initial goal was to keep him in the juvenile system, where he could get treatment instead of punishment. Though Jake had not been diagnosed with a mental illness at this point, it was clear something was very wrong. But if he had been tried as a juvenile, the state would have had to release him at age 18, way too short a time, in the judge's view, to protect society from Jake and Jake from himself. So 6 months after the murder, the judge decided Jake would be tried as an adult, and he was arraigned and transferred to the county jail. Now that it was no longer a question who killed Eric Kane, Eric's parents turned their grief and rage on Jake. They wanted the state to pursue the death penalty, even though Jake was only 16.